Our first case is Givens versus Ludlow, case number 2011-SC-899. Both parties ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's take care of a couple of housekeeping matters. First, petitioners will have to keep track of your time. Argument set for an hour, half hour aside. And I will tell you, what we did is when the clock goes down to zero, the thing goes back up. So we'll change that for our next set of arguments. So it's a little confusing to you, but the reason it's good for me is I know how much if someone goes over, I can give the other side the option. But so just sort of take a look at that. You'll see, you'll think you have 2 minutes and you're actually going the wrong way. Not in your argument, of course. The other thing I wanted to mention was that when you take the podium and start your argument, please tell us who you represent and who you are. And for those of you here and in the audience, some of us have iPads, and those of us that use them love them. But we have all the briefs, we have a link to Westlaw, and our notes on the iPads, and so we're not surfing and answering emails. Just wanted to let you all know that. With that, we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
Thank you, and good morning, Your Honors. I'm Kenneth L. Levinson, here on behalf of the petitioners, Linda S. Givens, Brent Wilson, and Givens White, Inc. I have probably 5 minutes worth of argument, and the rest of the time will devote to questions or anything else the court would like us to do here this morning. This case has to do with causation and damages, and I know you've all read the briefs, so I'm not going to waste your time going through those. The Court of Appeals adopted a but-for test, which is consistent with Colorado law, regarding whether the legal, or in this case, the malpractice or alleged malpractice of a licensed real estate broker can be the cause of damages causing a seller of property to sell the property for less than its appraised value. And we find no cases anywhere where that's ever been adopted as a measure of damages. The Court of Appeals used the but-for test, which is consistent with Colorado law. There's an old long history of cases where you look to see what would have happened but for the alleged wrongful conduct of the licensed professional. The Court of Appeals then looked at two ways to go with that. One would be the better deal scenario, the other is the no deal scenario. And the court actually sort of indirectly created a third category, which is better deal, but not with the person you're negotiating with, but with some potential third party. And they call that the no deal scenario, at least in part. I don't know that it really matters to the analysis of the case, but it looked like they sort of crossed, I don't want to say crossed the line, but sort of adopted a hybrid test. Where the Court of Appeals logic went wrong is in applying the no deal scenario. Because there has to be evidence of what would have happened had there not been a deal. That's the but-for part of this. And so, regardless of exactly how you categorize it, the two characters are either another sale to someone else, or that somehow you would have been better off simply keeping the asset. And we start with a proposition which we think distinguishes this from all of the lost or damaged property cases, which is, you have a seller or an owner of property who wants to divest themselves of ownership. In other words, they no longer want to be the owner of the property. And because this is a professional malpractice case, we believe the Court of Appeals was correct in using the but-for approach, and you don't use the appraised value approach, which they used. Again, I'm getting a little confusing here. They went back, they used the but-for test, but then they sort of shifted over to the appraised value. And the Court of Appeals essentially based part of their finding or their determination on an assumption that there might have been a better deal out there. But there was no evidence of anybody still interested in this property. Bush, who had been the prior party submitting an offer to buy this property, had lost interest in the property. They turned their paperwork over to Actis and never showed any further interest in buying this property. The Court of Appeals relied on testimony of Mr. Groves that someone had told him there was interest in the property. But this was a Rule 56 motion, and that was not admissible evidence. It's hearsay, in fact, double hearsay of someone told Mr. Groves that someone else was interested in the property. And so we don't think the court was should have relied on that as some.
Excuse me, Ms. Lattis. Sure. Could you tell me exactly what the deposition testimony was? What did he say?
Actually, yes. They said they were no longer marketing the property. This was, oh, I'm sorry, do you mean?
I mean as to the other buyers.
Yeah, what Mr. Groves said was.
What did he specifically say?
That he had heard, he believed from Mr. Wilson that there were other people who had interest in the property.
But that was because he wanted to act quickly. That was an explanation.
Right.
So it's admissible to show his state of mind, but certainly not for the truth of the matter, sir, right?
Exactly. That would be our argument. Thank you. And so we think that this property had been on the market for 7 years. The only buyer who was willing to and did go forward was Actis, but they were never willing to pay the full price. They were willing to pay the price if someone else spent $1.6 million on infrastructure. So there simply was no better deal. So you then turn to the issue of the appraised value. And our problem with using the appraised value, we didn't really articulate this in our briefs, but as I was preparing for this today, it really struck me. Essentially, that creates a fiction that there's some buyer out there willing to buy this property for its fair market, or in this case, its appraised value. And that essentially creates a deal in the no-deal scenario that simply doesn't exist. There was no evidence of anybody who was willing to pay the appraised value for this property. And so we think the Court of Appeals, by finding that there was evidence of damage, simply leaped across a chasm that doesn't exist.
Counsel, I'm sorry, can I stop you there just for one second? I'm just trying to make sure I understand your argument. You're saying that the problem with using the appraised value is not so much that the appraised value has nothing to do with the actual market value of the property, but relying on the appraised value alone does not establish the existence of a potential buyer, and that's the problem here. The likelihood that a sale, in fact, would have occurred
Correct.
Is not established through the appraised value.
Yes.
So if in another situation, evidence of an appraised value was presented, coupled with other market evidence showing the probability or the likelihood of such a sale, that might get you over the threshold.
Yeah, you know, I spent some time trying to figure out how the no-deal scenario could work. And the only thing I could come up with is somehow evidence of some buyer who's not only there, but has indicated some willingness or interest in paying that appraised value. Without that, as the trial court and Judge Lowe said, it's just speculation.
Well, don't we have to assume that there's negligence and we're trying to figure out what the measure of damages might be? That wouldn't be off the charts speculative. And don't we use the appraised value all the time in all kinds of circumstances? It requires a, you know, expert, if you will. And it is used in all kinds of financing transactions and condemnations and all kinds of aspects. So why isn't that, despite the fact that in a down market, the sale of this property might have lingered for quite a while, why isn't that the best, most reliable measure of getting at the damages?
Well, it might be a valid measure of damages, but I think what we're talking before you get to the measure is causation. And the problem is, as the trial court and Judge Lowe said, you have to look at when would the sale have occurred and how and under what circumstances. And the problem with the no-deal scenario is, you know, if there had been, as Judge Marcus said, another buyer who was out there or some evidence that someone was really willing to do it, that would make the time frame current. In this case, it's a question of if and when anybody would have ever bought that property, and if so, would they have paid?
Well, we do have a sale here.
Correct.
Okay.
But not for the price that it was appraised for, because the buyer wasn't willing to pay that price. The buyer was willing to pay much less because there was no infrastructure.
Well, it just seems to me that the argument you're making here is, you know, a wrong without any kind of remedy. I mean, I think that's what you're asking. You're suggesting everything else is basically speculative.
Can I ask a question that kind of tees off of Justice Hobbs? So you have what you're calling transaction malpractice, essentially, that the broker didn't get a good enough deal.
Right.
But there was a deal. So the measure of damage, according to the plaintiff, should be the difference between what the deal was and what the deal could have been but for the malpractice, right?
Right.
And
although they've shifted the measure of damages as the case has gone on, but yes.
So, but we have a bottom number, that is what the deal, what was received. Right. We have a cause of action, that is what should have been or could have been received but for the malpractice. So our worry is the top number. Right.
Right.
But for the malpractice, what would have been received?
Right.
All right. And how would you instruct? What is your theory of a measure of damage? Let's come at it from that.
Sure. Well, and in this case, that's the problem, because there is no top number. There was nobody willing to pay that top amount.
Well,
the buyer wasn't. And so there was either no deal at all, because the seller says we wouldn't have sold at that number knowing we were going to be paying the infrastructure. The buyer says, well, I wasn't going to buy at that.
So your position is that there might have been transactional malpractice, but it's sort of no harm, no foul. There's no damage.
Yeah, although for the record, we do disagree that there was actually any malpractice.
Well,
but
I understand that, but with respect to the measure of damage, your position is, yes, theoretically, there is a measure of damage that is the difference between what it was sold for, what it could have been sold for, but for the malpractice. But here, there is no non-speculative evidence of what it could have been sold for, but for the malpractice.
Exactly.
Therefore, there is no evidence at all. Therefore, there is no damage.
Correct.
Is my logic right? Does it track what you're trying to argue?
It's better than what I was arguing, yes. That states it very well. Thank you.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
Maybe I've misunderstood here. Is there an argument, is it being advanced by your opponents here, that there is value to this property, whether it's sold or not? And if it has been sold as a result of malpractice for less than the value, then the owner of the property has been deprived of the right to hold a more valuable asset.
And that is their theory, which of course I'll let them articulate. But the problem in this case is that because of the way the economy went, that value of the property went down by substantially more than what they lost.
But is that not an argument that the appraisal was no good?
No, because the appraisal was done as of the date of sale, and then you have to look at, well, when would it have sold to somebody who was willing to pay that amount?
And I guess that's the question for me. I'm asking, the way you're approaching it is you have to look to when it would be sold and for how much in order to determine whether they'd actually been deprived of holding a valuable asset.
Right.
But isn't their argument not that, but rather they're simply entitled to hold this asset, and if they've lost it for less than its value, then they've been damaged?
That is their argument. And our problem with that is this isn't a damage to property case where I've got some asset that I love and cherish and want to keep. This is an asset that they wanted to sell. They started the process of trying to sell the property, and essentially we're leaving the broker in a position of having to guarantee they'll find a buyer willing to pay the appraised value.
I'm not sure I follow that entirely, but it sounds to me a little like you're saying, well, they just brought the wrong kind of action back, because the only thing you could be, the only thing in a malpractice for the sale that you could be held liable for is selling it for less than they could have sold it to someone else.
Well, in a sense, that's right, because there was nobody else willing to pay that amount. And I understand, we're here talking about essentially which framework applies. Do you use the destruction of property framework where you just look at a diminution of fair market value? Or, as we're arguing, do you use the legal malpractice framework of the but-for and the no-deal or deal scenarios, which in our view makes the damages complete speculation as to what loss they really did suffer?
Well, you know, that really is. That just sounds like you would, that's a hopeful outcome for you. It doesn't sound like to me that it's based upon the fact that the law presumes that there's a connection between the malpractice and the damages that occur from it. So we have to have some workable, practical measure of damages, right? I mean, that's our job. You're offering us none. So what's your alternative? Don't you just argue the trier of fact? Was you're talking about offsets or something else?
I think there's a difference between the measure of damages and legal causation, which requires any damage. And maybe you better lay that out.
Sure, thank you. And that really is our issue. What we're arguing is the chain of causation for a broker not telling the seller and the lawyer, hey, you better go read this part of this paragraph of the document that you're then drafting a contract based on, that whole chain, and then not anticipating that the lawyer wouldn't read it, wouldn't draft it properly, wouldn't make that clause supreme over the clause in the addendum, that chain is so remote, and then to lead to, well, they lost this property or sold it for less than its appraised value because broker, you didn't tell their lawyer.
Mr. Levinson, I hate to interrupt you, but damages are required as part of legal causation, right?
Right.
A fact of damage.
Yes.
Isn't that right?
Right.
Then the measure of damage is something which, for example, you use an appraisal over the value or whatever. Correct?
Yes.
And that would be for the jury to determine. Right?
Assuming
that there's damage.
Right.
Assuming there's damage. So you're talking about legal causation of approximate cause, right?
Right.
Okay. So what's the difference? How do you explain that in the context of this case? Because I think that needs to be clarified.
Right. And part of what I was saying is the causation is too remote. The second is, it is not clear. I mean, we're starting...
Oh, wait, isn't your basic position that there is no damage in this case legally?
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
It's not that the plaintiffs might not think that they suffered a loss, right?
Yes.
All right. And if there were a legal damage, then we have to look at their measure of damage in a different way, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And that actually summarizes my argument. Unless there are other questions,
I'm sorry, we're not going to go quite that quick.
That's fine.
What was your client? He was accused of not, the malpractice that was alleged was not making sure that the contract was correct. I'm using extreme shorthand, is that right?
Well, not pointing out a change in the contract.
Okay.
That as a transaction broker, he made because that's what the buyer wanted.
And I understand that this is kind of the new application of a tort, transactional malpractice. I mean, so there's something about the way that transaction unfolded that caused the damage. I'm basically kind of following on what the chief had to say.
I'm sorry?
I'm basically following up on what the chief had to say.
Right.
Did you file a motion? You didn't file a motion to dismiss, right? I mean, what was the procedural posture?
We filed a summary judgment.
Summary judgment?
And actually, the lawyer defense filed the summary judgment motion. We joined it and added to that.
And basically you were saying there's just no damage here.
Right, no legal causation, and any causation is too speculative.
So if you just go back to classic duty breach, causation, damage, you're saying no causation or no damage?
Both. No causation and no damages caused by the wrongful act of the defendants.
Okay, that helps. Thank you.
Sure. If there are any other questions?
Well, wait, what is a transactional broker? Well, what does that person do? What kind of relationship and duties are owed to the person that hires that?
A transaction broker is a neutral party who represents neither side in the transaction. They don't advocate for either party. Essentially, they're mediator isn't the right word, but they're a facilitator to put a transaction.
But they're hired for their expertise in the transaction, right? And you rely on their counsel, do you not?
No, because a transaction broker has to be really careful about giving counsel and advice. They have to stay neutral. They can advise as to problems with the transaction that they're aware of, but they can't advocate for either side.
But do they have a duty to look at the contract and advise those who employ them as to what it says, and if an amendment occurs, what that amendment, what effect that amendment has on the transaction?
No, because that involves them in the unauthorized practice of law, especially here in a transaction where both sides have attorneys. I mean, they have to be really careful about not giving legal advice. Under the Conway Boat case, they can fill out forms and generally, you know, do the transactional part of it, but they have to be really careful.
Okay, but what about the duty to say, look, at this change has occurred? Flag something, you know, because, you know, these real estate things are like, they're written in that little small print. They have a lot of complicated languages. They refer to other things. And when amendments are made, it's significant, right? So at least there's some duty. What is the duty of the transaction broker from a real estate standpoint?
Sure. Essentially, their duty is to point out adverse material facts or issues. And the problem here was even the Ludlows, the seller's own attorney, said, you couldn't tell whether this was a problem until somebody drafted that reimbursement agreement. In other words, the agreement started out with the buyer is going to do all the infrastructure, get reimbursed by the seller. As the document evolved and the brokers had nothing to do with that, it shifted so that either party could do infrastructure and be reimbursed by the other party. And so the language that's causing all these problems should have been changed, because there was no longer a question of the buyer being reimbursed at closing, because it wasn't clear they were going to really be doing all of the infrastructure. But when the lawyer drafted that reimbursement agreement, he didn't go back and look at that language in the paragraph that required the reimbursement agreement, and he didn't say, uh-oh, I better make this reimbursement agreement have priority or supersede the other language. And so there was this ambiguity left as to what was being reimbursed when. And the broker, at the time this came up, he even emailed the seller and said, my understanding is this relates to off-site infrastructure. And the buyer meant on-site, but never responded to that email. So the broker simply didn't know this was a problem. And in that case, where he doesn't have actual knowledge of something adverse, there's no duty under the statute to disclose or to explain that to the either party.
Okay. Mr.
Robinson,
good morning.
Good morning.
How does the fact that this is postured in a motion for summary judgment affect your argument? Do you think at all? Because as I read this, it strikes me that the issue is, does the fact that they had an appraisal, unconsummated deals, and evidence, potential evidence of some other buyers, create a material issue of fact? Is that kind of in a nutshell?
It is. And there really is no evidence of any actual potential buyers. I mean, we think that gets into pure speculation.
But I mean, for purposes of, that's what I'm saying, for purposes of summary judgment, ultimately you're talking about objection, Your Honor, at trial, right? I mean, what I'm talking about is, again, this is in the posture of a motion for summary judgment where inferences need to be given and sure, things like that. How do you think the posture of this case affects how we do this?
Sure. And our argument is there simply wasn't sufficient evidence to create a material disputed issue of fact. There was speculation, guesswork, there might have been or could have been, but those possibilities didn't rise to enough level of actual evidence that a jury could rely on to find that there was causation and damage.
But doesn't the appraisal, isn't the appraisal some evidence of the value, and then you might introduce, if it's the no-deal scenario, then you would introduce the appraisal that you got sometime later that the value of the property had decreased substantially, and you'd say to the jury, look, they benefited from this because they would have lost money, and that's for the jury to decide.
Well, in part, that's true. And we have an appraisal that said even at the time of the sale, the property was worth a lot less than the plaintiff's appraiser says. But it's still, you know, their own appraiser said whether anybody would actually have bought that property is purely a guess that he couldn't hazard. And so there just simply wasn't enough evidence that anybody would have taken that property for the fair market value or for the appraised value. And so, as the trial court said, I think you're just guessing as to when and how and under what circumstances someone would have bought. Would they have also insisted on the infrastructure and so on? And so, essentially, you're creating a deal where no deal existed and then applying the deal as being the value of the appraisal of the property. And so we just think it's too remote.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Watts.
Thank you. With that, I think I'll shut up and sit down and save a little time in case I need it for later. Thank you.
Okay, please, the court. I'm John Hensley. And along with Jeremy Swift, who's at counsel table, and Paul Cooper, we represent the plaintiffs in the underlying actions, Greg Ludlow, Reed Ludlow, and their sister, Jean Coles. For the this argument, I will refer to them collectively as the Ludlows and the defendant brokers as the brokers. I think it's important, and certainly based on some of the questions that some of the justices have asked already this morning, to go back and look at where we were at in this case in the trial court when it stopped. It's important for the purposes of the issues on this appeal to view them in the context of summary judgment proceedings. That's where we were. The background of the transaction, while I don't want to spend a lot of time going over that, I think also is important because it puts some of these questions into the real context of this case. And ultimately what this court's going to have to decide is whether or not it agrees with the Court of Appeals' reversal of the trial court's grant of the summary judgment. This action arose from a business relationship of the Ludlows with the defendant brokers that started in 2000. The Ludlows had a family farm, and they were interested in marketing the farm. They ended up entering into a brokerage relationship with the Gibbons White brokerage firm to market their farm. And it had different parts of it. There were some parts that perhaps would be developed for different purposes. So it was not just a singular parcel, although this contract was with respect to a particular portion of that property. When they entered into the contract, and this goes a bit to some of the questions that were asked by Justice Hobbs with respect to the duties of the brokers. Although the Court of Appeals did not agree with the Ludlow's position that throughout the course of these 7 years getting to the Actus contract, that the brokers were representing them as their agents, the fact of the matter is that the Ludlows had worked closely with the Gibbons White firm for 7 years in attempts to market this property that they owned. When the contract ultimately with Actus, which is the subject of the lawsuit, was entered into, because of the transaction broker addendum document, which went back to the year 2000, 7 years earlier, the brokers did make any point to the Ludlows that they were changing their relationship.
Mr. Hensley, I don't mean to. I am interrupting you, and I apologize for that. But I kind of want to get back to the basic issue in this case.
Okay.
There are, as I see it, there's a duty. And this is a negligence case, so there's a duty. We assume a duty because of the grant of motion for summary judgment. We assume a breach. Now, the issue is whether or not, in most negligence cases, there's a cause and fact, right?
That's correct.
But you also have to have damages. And in this case, because there's a motion for summary judgment that was granted, the issue becomes really twofold. First, is there any theory, a factual theory, in which you had an argument to overcome summary judgment? But the real issue that we're here to decide in this case is what's the proper test for damages? Because if you don't have damages, you don't have causation, you don't have proximate cause. And Cardozo wrote the great piece dealing with proximate cause damages being a limitation of liability, right? So now what I want to know is why specifically have you established facts which tell us that the trial judge was wrong in granting summary judgment on the issue of causation? And he said specifically, the finding was that there's no, there wasn't a lone buyer. And so I think it's pretty much as Mr. Levinson explained, no deal scenario, it's a but-for test. So what's wrong about that?
Well, going back to the ruling of the trial court, what's wrong with that is the trial court didn't apply the no deal
analysis. I'm sorry, you're right.
And I think that was the court's error.
Okay, but what's the issue here that we have? What should we do here? I forget the trial court. You had a summary judgment.
I think that this case can be viewed in one of two analyses, either of which comes to the same result. And that result being it was error to grant the motion for summary judgment because we have sufficient evidence to go to the jury.
What's the basis?
Now I will take you through that. The Court of Appeals in its analysis applied the case within a case analysis. I think Justice Rice's question was also very appropriate, which is, if we look at this as a straight negligence case, we've got duty, we've got breach, we've got damages.
Causation damages.
That's correct. That's correct. So I think you can get to that point either through the case within a case analysis, but in this particular case, I don't think we need to go there. But let's go through the case within a case analysis that was applied by the Court of Appeals. In that case, the Court of Appeals looked at decisions in other jurisdictions, and particularly in one of the cases that has been talked about quite a bit is the Viner case. And Viner is the case which talks about you can prove this causation through either the better result or through the no-deal analysis. And in Viner was a case where the plaintiffs who had engaged the attorneys and then brought their action against the attorneys were seeking to sell a business. So in that sense, it's no different. This distinction that counsel for the petitioner attempted to make that, well, we don't really apply that because they were trying to sell something, isn't correct. Because under Viner, that's exactly what they were trying to do. And in Viner, the court looks at the case within a case analysis. And again, because this is summary judgment, it very clearly is admitted in the briefs by the petitioners, they do not dispute duty, they do not dispute breach. So we're looking at causation.
I was just looking at that Viner case, and they're using something called a substantial factor test as opposed to a but-for. Could you just tell me about that, please?
Yes. Well, the substantial factor is, if you look under the restatement of torts, when it's talking right. about cause, the but-for is typically applied where you have a single alleged negligent actor. Mm-hmm. When you have concurrent actors that are allegedly negligent, then you look at the substantial factor. Because it doesn't work to say but for, because here that's somewhat what the brokers are trying to do. They're saying but for the negligence of the lawyers,
sure,
these damages wouldn't occur.
So your cause of action is that but for or the negligence of the broker was a substantial factor.
Yes.
And then of the damage, and I understand that we're all dancing around this problem with cause because damage folds into cause here. Because you have to cause something and you have to cause damage, and therefore we have to measure damage and kind of work backwards. Does
yes.
that make sense to you, the way I just expressed it?
Yes, it does.
But how do we do that here? I mean, what is your measure of damage, if you will, and we're working backwards?
The measure of damage is the difference in the value of the asset, which the seller had, versus what they received in the sale, where they're forced, in this case, like this case, forced to part with it unwillingly. At a lesser amount than they wanted to sell it for or what it was worth.
Why unwillingly?
Because of the specific performance provision in the real estate contract. And this takes us all the way back to, going back to the substantial causal factor, the testimony of Mr. Ludlow is that had he been told what the broker knew, that the broker had inserted this deduction from the purchase price, but never told the seller, he wouldn't have signed the contract, because he understood that the selling price was exactly what the purchase price was. It's stated twice on the face of the contract. It's on the very first page, it says purchase price, and then in section 4 of the real estate contract, it says again the purchase price, then it shows cash at closing, etc. So his understanding when entering into the contract, which is before the lawyers got involved in this particular contract, was that the purchase price was what it stated on there, because the broker didn't tell him that they had complied with the request of the buyer and put in a credit for the buyer in the contract. And interestingly, in this case, the evidence in the record is that when the broker sent the contract to the buyer, and this goes to duty of a transaction broker, when they sent the contract to the buyer, they said, we've included the deduction from the purchase price. When they sent the contract to the seller, who they're supposed to communicate with equally, they don't say a thing about putting a credit in there for the purchase price.
Well, I think that's kind of assumed for the purpose of our decision here, right? So what's the damages?
So
how do you have damage? Justice Marcus, forget what we call it, asked about the appraisal. So you have an appraisal, let's assume that, and there's a contrary appraisal apparently.
I'm sorry.
There was a contrary appraisal as well.
That's correct.
But the appraisal does not indicate that someone wanted to buy it. It may indicate that's what the appraisal thought the value of the property was. No question about that.
Well, I think there's two responses to that.
Okay, so what's
the first response is we don't have to prove that there's another buyer out there.
Why not? I guess that's where I'm getting hung up. Because what other purpose would you be holding onto the property? And I go back to your opposing counsel's comment. This is not a situation where you had no intention, or the sellers had no intention of selling the farm. They absolutely wanted to market the farm. That's why they engaged the brokers. The whole point was to get rid of the property. The whole point was to sell it. So don't we need to show that not merely that the appraised value was X, but that there was some likelihood of actually selling the property, and then we can fight about it at what value?
Well, I don't think we do.
Well, and why not?
This is a negligence case against the brokers. If you look at the body of negligence law in Colorado, which has been developed for quite a long time, there is no other negligence case where we put that burden on a plaintiff. Let's take a couple examples. Or a loss of property case. Let's look at a conversion case. I come into your house and I steal your painting, and you bring an action against me for taking your property. You didn't want to part with it, but I have your property. You bring the case, you put on the value of what your painting is worth. You don't have to prove that you're going to sell it to somebody. You don't have to prove that there was a person ready to buy it the next day. Let's go to another period of time.
All that makes sense to me, but to me the fundamental difference is I didn't want to part with that property. That's not the case here.
Well, another difference too. Someone has a property. You've already received a certain amount of monies for that property. Maybe it isn't what you wanted, but you got whatever, 3/4 of the purchase price, which you thought you did. So what do you have to prove?
All right, Justin, let me put that into automobile negligence. You're sitting there at the red light. It turns green. You proceed through. I come through, and I total your car. You get $400 salvage value for it. You receive some money for your property. You have a loss of your property. You receive some money for it. So I am liable to you for the difference between the fair market value. Do you have to prove that you have someone ready to buy your car? No, you don't. So, you know, that's a red herring that's been interjected into this whole analysis by brokers, this whole idea of we have to prove there was someone who was wanting to buy it.
Well, what do you have to prove, though? I'm sorry, we've asked this. But maybe you would just tell me just in a single sentence what you think you have to prove.
We have to prove that we would have been better off but for the negligence of the broker. And we would have been better off if we would have not entered into the deal, which there's undisputed evidence that we would not have entered into the deal had the broker not misrepresented the contract.
What is the evidence that you would have been better off?
The evidence is the value of the asset that we had.
That's the appraised value? What else?
We also have the Bush contract.
The contract that fell through?
the contract that fell through. And okay. It's important, I think, to recognize the Bush contract was in November of 2006. It was terminated on February 6th of 2007. This contract's February 23 of 2007. So it's certainly temporal. And it showed a willing buyer at the price, $3 a square foot, exact same price as what we were talking about for the 44 acres in this case. So I don't think you disregard it. It wasn't a mere offer. It was a contract between the parties. So I think it has
to ask you a question right about that. With regard to your what I take as being called a no-deal scenario, I'm not sure how these terms are being used, but is a prospective buyer, is your evidence of a prospective buyer relevant at all for purposes of your theory that you've simply been deprived of holding a property that's worth more?
It's not. It's not, and it goes back to my point. The no deal, what has happened here in the way that it's been argued by the brokers is they've transferred this concept of no deal into yet another deal. They aren't satisfied with leaving it at there would have been no deal, but rather we have to show there have been yet another deal. That's not a no deal. A no deal is this contract would not have happened. Had this contract not happened, we would have had an asset worth $6.6 million under our evidence.
Can I ask a slightly broader question, a little different from the way we've been approaching this, and that is, how is an appraisal, or the appraisal in this case, related to a sale, to a prospective sale, or is it at all? And does it make a difference what kind of an appraisal it is and what the appraisal is based on?
It does. I think this gets us into talking about appraisal. This court in Bly versus Story, which was decided in 2012, majority opinion by Justice Hobbs and a dissent by Justice Hyde, talked about appraisals and the different methods of appraisals. That was a case where there was a condemnation of an access and there was an existing roadway, and the question was whether or not the trial court erred in not permitting evidence of the value of the cost of construction. You know, we have the three approaches under appraisal. We have the comparative sale analysis, the income analysis, and the cost analysis. And that was discussed at some length in that opinion. And I think that's important for a couple of things here. One, it does talk about different types of appraisal. Here, our appraisal was primarily based upon a comparative sale analysis. The Bly versus Story opinion, in that the court also recognized these other methods of appraisal, but overall, what the court really was saying there is, when a condemnation case, like this case, where you own land but you're forced to part with it against your will, you're entitled to the value. That's constitutional in Colorado. It's the underpinnings of our eminent domain statute. And so when you look at what was the value that landowner had, you can do that by appraisal, which is exactly what we did here.
And let me just follow up on that briefly. I appreciate that breakdown. So if the appraisal had been based, though, on something other than a comparative sale, how much you could produce out of the farm or something like that, would it seem that your argument about holding a valuable asset and now being deprived of holding that would be stronger than an appraisal that is based on the whatever the technique is, comparative sales? So basically it's a projection or a proposal or a prediction about what you could sell this property for based on what sales have been in the past. And the reason I ask that is there an inconsistency, and you can explain why there's not, so I'm sure you feel there's not, between relying on a no-deal approach when the appraisal is based on comparative sales, as opposed to, I mean, I can see where you might want to say, well, no, there's sufficient evidence of a sale, of a prospective sale, simply in the fact that we've got an appraisal from somebody on comparative sales. That might be one argument, but that sounds like that's not really what you're arguing. You're arguing you're just being deprived of a valuable asset, and yet the value of the asset seems to be based on a comparative sale or a prediction of sale.
It's a method of coming up with a value. It's not the only way to value it. We could have evidence to go to the jury by Mr. Ludlow saying what he thought his property was worth. Colorado law allows a property owner to provide testimony with respect to what they think their property is worth. We don't have to have an appraisal. We could demonstrate, when permitted to go to trial in this case, that there are other ways to establish some value. But when we got stopped, discovery wasn't completed. You know, this case was working toward trial, but the summary judgment, when it happened, what we had at that time as competent evidence of the value of our property was an appraisal. So the question for the summary judgment, that's where we were at in this case. For summary judgment, did we have evidence of the value of our property would be admissible trial? And the answer very simply, yes, we did.
Well, counsel, just to follow up on that, I mean, didn't you have to have value of cause? Or, I'm sorry, evidence of cause, not evidence of value?
Well, I believe both.
Okay.
Yes.
So following up on the cause, I mean, let me just restate your theory. Had you kept this property and not sold it, you would have had an asset that was worth more that you could eventually sell for more? Is that correct?
If we chose to.
If you chose to. Okay. And then I guess I'm hearing the best evidence that you have of that causal scenario is an appraisal. And this is one step further. Are you asking us to draw an inference from the appraisal because it was based on comparative sales? That's an inference of a willing buyer. I guess your argument is that you don't have to have a physical willing buyer ready to pay the money, but appraisal is at least some evidence that there might be a willing buyer at that price. Is that too far of a stretch, or just help me understand that?
Fundamentally, what I'm arguing is under the no deal analysis, you don't have to prove a sale at a later time. What, under the no-deal analysis, where would you have been left but for the deal?
But isn't the whole basis of that fair market value, and the market includes some component of a willing buyer,
again,
whether he's standing there or not?
Do you reject
the whole conclusion
of fair? We have to prove we had a buyer ready, willing, and able.
Well, I'm agreeing with you on that. I guess I'm saying that's what you're arguing, correct? That you don't need to have someone who's actually standing there. But don't you need to show some evidence of the fair market value of this property, which includes a component of people willing to buy it at that price? Maybe not an actual person or entity willing to buy it.
I would agree that inherent in the definition of fair market value is a willing buyer, willing seller. That's how we get to what is fair market value under Colorado law. That doesn't require, look at any of the cases. I mean, go back to Bly versus Story. You know, you're looking at what was the value of the loss of this plaintiff. Nobody said, but were they going to sell their property? No. Appraisers don't have to say that, in fact, a sale would occur. When you're doing a comparative sale approach, you take from sales that have occurred. From that, you say there is a market for properties of this type. And what is in that market? What is this value? And that's what appraisers do. As you recognize, and you recognize, they oftentimes are asked to appraise properties where there aren't many comparable sales in Bly versus Story in your dissent. So if you going back to Viner, going to the no-deal approach, and I think this is instructive, the reason that the plaintiffs in Viner were unable to show causation and loss in their malpractice claim against the attorneys in that case was they wanted to sell this business. When they sold the business, there were carried back monies that were supposed to be paid, and those monies weren't paid to them. They brought seven claims against the attorneys, one of which was I should have had a security interest for those payments. But they put on no evidence that the purchasers would have agreed to a security interest, which is essentially the argument the lawyer defendants made in this case. We had no evidence that Actis would have agreed to withdraw that credit that they had placed in the contract. So then the buyer and claimant say, well, but we could have made more money than we ended up getting because we had these opportunities to go do these other deals. And the court says, well, that's a nice argument. The problem with that is those were corporate opportunities of the business that you sold. So as individual plaintiffs, you haven't shown me here that you suffered any loss. And importantly, they said they didn't have any evidence of the value of their business. The court says, you don't have any evidence that the value of your business was more than you got paid for it. And that's what this case is about. We have evidence that the value of our property was more than what we got paid for, and that's why it's distinguished from Viner. But if you follow the logic, we've met the test in Viner.
Thank you.
just a little correction for the record here. Counsel for petitioners, two or three times in this argument, several times in the brief, said there was nobody else out there interested in the property. Well, I think you look at the record, it's going to need to stand corrected. In the exhibit I, the plaintiff's response to their motion for summary judgment, which is in the record at page 1533, there's an email from the Bush Development Company after they had terminated their contract on February the 6th. They sent an email on February the 14th, which says to Mr. Ludlow, "I wish you the best of luck with the new buyer." That was Actis. These parties knew each other quite a bit. "Although Bush Development really hopes that we will get another shot at it." Bush was interested in the property. They were hoping to get another shot at it if it didn't work with Actis. To say there was no interested purchaser out there, I think is a bit of a stretch on the record. The other thing that I think we have to look at in that, with respect to that issue, is the real estate contract, which was prepared by the brokers. If you look at this 8-page addendum, and you look at paragraph 12, there was an express prohibition of the Ludlows against marketing, entering into negotiations, accepting offers. During the term of the Actis contract, they were contractually prohibited from seeking other purchasers. They couldn't take a backup contract and couldn't even enter into negotiations. Yet the brokers come in and say, "Well, golly gee, you know what? At the end of the Actis contract, they didn't have anybody else lined up," as though they should have breached their contractual duties. So, I don't think this issue of is there another buyer, I think I've been very clear, isn't something we believe we needed to prove. I think that with respect to that factual issue, if the court is interested here in the record, I think there's a question of fact.
Why'd the other deal fall through?
Because Bush wanted to put a movie theater in as their anchor tenant, and they were unable to get that anchor tenant in place. And they had a 90-day due diligence period starting from November 16th, so it ended February 16th. They realized they weren't going to get their anchor tenant, and so economically wasn't going to work for them. Apparently, Bush didn't have the wherewithal to hold the property and go look for another anchor tenant, so they had to give it up. That's when they let Actis and Mr. Groves know that they were having to let that property go. I mean, this happened very quickly. They were out February 6th. We're under contract February 23rd with Actis. And you know, that's why the Bush contract had been reviewed by counsel. Mr. Ludlow was very familiar with it. They'd been working under that. And the broker says, "I've got you the same deal with Actis as you had with Bush, except three little things here are different, none of which would discredit against the purchase price." Why he didn't tell him, I don't know. But it obviously is very material, and it's the reason they signed the contract. And again, I don't think that for summary judgment, that has to be accepted as true. So the duty and the breach, I don't think there's an issue for this court.
Let me just ask a question that's been kind of bothering me. I'm sure there's a really easy answer. Why isn't that credit your measure of damage?
Well, it ends up being, in this case, essentially the same, because the appraised value was 6.6. This contract price was $6,550,000, which is a $50,000, which in the scheme of $6.5 million is relatively minor dollar differential. So they just happen to work out about the same.
But just conceptually, that seems easier to me as a measure of damage. Square causation for measure of damage is what you lost as a result of the broker transaction.
Well, I agree that it would be tempting for a plaintiff to go there, but I think that under our theory, we have to look at what was the value of what we had. We can't say it's just a 6. Because if, in fact, the jury determines that what we had is what we got paid the value of our property, we don't have a loss. So it's not the straight $1.6 million, although in the context of this case...
Well it's appealing because you had a deal, and it's much easier to show what you're out because you didn't know this other provision, right?
Well, yes, but that's a benefit of the bargain.
So you made a bargain.
Well, I don't believe that under the proper measure of damages that it's a benefit of the bargain. That's a contractual.
No, but you're in the deal. So why is an out-of-pocket loss basically the measure?
You're saying it's a contract as opposed to tort.
It's a benefit of the bargain.
But what really would be the difference here?
But here it works out to be about the same. That's what I'm saying.
But I mean, even if it didn't.
In this case, the issue is the difference between the value of the asset we had and what we received for it. the cost reduction clause, its importance here is that it is the reason that we have damage. Had we known, we would have entered into the contract. Mm-hmm. But I don't believe an accurate assessment of the damages really is just a straight 1.6, although it's convenient, and certainly plaintiffs would be willing to go to trial on that kind of damage. But I think we have to look at, we have to prove what was the value of what we had and what did we receive in exchange, and that's what we lost. There are no further questions. We respectfully ask this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals and send this case back to the trial court so that the Ludlows have a chance to have their day in court.
Thank you, Mr. Hensel.
Thank you.
You have some additional time, I think, Mr. Ludlows. 6 minutes, 19 seconds.
And I just do want to raise a few points. Justice Rice raises a good issue. And the problem with using the measure of damages as the credit that was given at closing is that gets to the better deal scenario, and the undisputed evidence was that Atkins would not agree to that. So that just wasn't something that could happen. But the second problem with that is that number was the number that the sellers and their attorney went off and negotiated with the buyers, and so the brokers had nothing to do with that number, and we would argue it was too remote to be causation.
You mean Actus wouldn't agree to close a deal where the purchase price was, did not have included within it this discount?
Correct. Actus said they wouldn't have bought it unless the
seller. But I would assume that it wouldn't be Actus who would be paying, it would be the broker.
Well,
aren't they the defendants here?
Right. The way it was left when they negotiated the contract was, we're going to do this cost reimbursement agreement, and then they went off and negotiated that after the contract was in effect. And Gross says he would never have signed the contract if he thought he was paying for the infrastructure costs. So he says he thought they were just negotiating how much he was going to get, but the agreement was actually negotiating who was going to do it and who was going to reimburse each other. One other point, the problem with the we would have just kept the property and we should use the appraised value is one of timing, because if you look at it as of the day of the closing and assume someone willing to buy that property on the day of closing for its appraised value, then you've got that damage. But if you look at what would have happened had they kept the property, this was when the economy went off the cliff, and this value of the property went down by over $3 million. So having kept the property, they would have lost $3 million. By selling it, they lost the 1.6 under their argument.
That is if they had sold it right then. But I've been a little curious about your whole theory here. How does timing play into this? Why wouldn't it be reasonable if they could show, for instance, a pattern of the property going up at a regular rate for them to have held it, or if they could show that it was a very short-term drop-off in the economy and they could have held it for a month and then sold it for more? Would all of those things be relevant?
I think so, and that was where the trial court had the problem, which is, what data do we use? Do we pick it just when the economy crashed, or just later till there's a recovery? What date do we use to value this if it's not the date of the sale? And the trial court felt it shouldn't be the date of the sale because there was nobody else willing to buy the property.
I was just going to say, doesn't the no-deal scenario, even though we talk about it as no-deal, and we're talking only about the value of the asset, whether they could hold it, you know, hold it, whether they were deprived of the right to hold a valuable asset, but doesn't that still figure into the possibility? I mean, the reason why that may be a meritorious argument is, well, they could hold it and sell it at some future point in time.
Right.
As long as they could make some reasonable projection about that, isn't that a reasonable way of it?
If there was some evidence in this case that there was somebody potentially out there, and Bush, the fact that they said they might want another shot at it, they would have had to find another anchor tenant and come back, and none of that ever happened. But you're right, I mean, you have to figure out, or have some evidence of the time frame of, well, you know, it was on the market for 7 years and didn't sell, that something had happened where now there was a reasonable probability that someone would buy it in some time frame.
And does it seem that their argument sort of is, well, if we've got an appraisal that's based on the comparative sales, that's enough to get past the motion for summary judgment.
And that is their argument, but we think it's too speculative. And as you pointed out earlier, this was not an income-producing property. We're only looking at, okay, here's what the appraiser says its value is, but even the appraiser had no idea whether anybody would ever actually pay that value. And that's a bit of evidence in this case that we think is real significant.
But the appraiser, if it's a comparative value, is saying, but people have paid this amount for a comparable property in the past, right?
Sure.
So actually, while we're still on that point, what, short of an actual live buyer with an offer or something like that, would get you past the summary judgment hurdle? Justice Boatwright has sort of laid out the evidence here, and your argument is that's not enough. If we're going to create a test or some sort of rule, what guidance should we give and what would meet that threshold?
Yeah. And that is a tough question.
That's why I'm asking.
I think there has to be some evidence of somebody really willing, more than just speculation, something that puts it in the realm of probabilities.
So what would be an example of that then?
The only thing I can think of is other people, you know, we've seen cases, for example, where there was a second buyer bidding for the property, or a buyer who was willing to pay a certain price, and the broker did something and somehow let the buyer know, oh, you can get this cheaper, and so they offered less than they had previously been willing to offer. But I think there just has to be some concrete evidence of what a better deal would have been, or the but-for, essentially. What would have happened but for the conduct of the professional that actually would have made a difference in the outcome, and not just might have made a difference.
And so the Bush offer that had fallen through, does it meet that? I mean, that's an expression of interest that fell apart for other reasons, but that wouldn't get you there because...
Well, it had been a contract, but I'm not so sure. When I went back and looked at the documents, it looked like Bush was paying, they bought a little different number of acreage and they were paying less money. It was more like in the 5-7 range. I'm not sure what the discrepancy is, but the fact that they said, well, we may come back if we can find an anchor tenant, I mean, those are a lot of ifs. And fortunately, in a sense, for the brokers in this case, the economy crashed, and we aren't in just a continuing increased market where, well, if we kept this property for a week, it would have gone up a little bit. Had we kept it for a year, it would have gone dramatically more. I mean, we happened to hit this time when, using the framework, the property went dramatically down in value. So I don't know. I mean, the no-deal scenario is a problem, and I don't see cases across the country where anybody's really dealt with that and said, here's what you have to prove to at least have enough to get past summary judgment or to get to a jury.
Thank you.
I just want to thank all of you for hearing this case and for granting cert in the first place.
We appreciate your thanks, and thank both of you for your arguments and briefs. Case will be submitted in the court.